Save big during Labor Day at Lowe's. Get up to 40% off select major appliances. Plus, buy more to get up to an additional 20% off. Shop even more savings with 3 Stay Green 1 cubic foot vegetable and flower garden soil bags for $10. This Labor Day, take care of your home for less at Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 9/3. Soil offer excludes Alaska and Hawaii. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
This is the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, the rhythm of the city. I'm Jose Candelario, here with a very astute gentleman, a very flashy dresser, if you can just imagine yourself, being on the cover of GQ. But he is also a community leader and a strong force for those who are returning citizens and those dealing with addictions. His name is Charles Grady. Charlie or Charles?
Which Charlie's one? Good.
Charlie Grady, so very personable. Charlie Grady, tell me where you're from. And
So, thank you, first of all, for having me here, man. This is a great vibe that you've built, and I got nothing but respect and love for what you're doing. You're the consummate professional, so I'll start by saying that. A little bit about me. Grew up in New Haven, Brookside. My father was a police officer. I had five uncles who were police officers at the time. In the early 60s, and at that time, there was this big migration to the suburbs. You know, once police officers, black police officers in particular, started making a steady salary and getting benefits, they tried to get out of the housing projects because they had a sense of the project starting to get a little bit hairy at that time. But everybody, the American dream has always been the house, the white picket fence, the 2.2 kids, and the dog, right? So it was no different for my father and my uncles. They worked hard as public servants. And so they served in New Haven. And I remember growing up in Brookside, it was the greatest experience of my life, man. I look back on it now, just that carefree time, you know, kindergarten, first. It was just amazing. The relationships that we had, my cousins, we all lived in the same area. And my mother, God rest her soul, she was the queen of socialization. And so I always tell people I got a great balance of my mother and my father and me, because she was the social butterfly, and there wasn't a party that she couldn't get started. You know, when she showed up, that's when the party started. And conversely, my father, as busy as he was working, you know, this was back during Black Panther days and so forth in New Haven. So we didn't see him as much, but I got a real strong sense of responsibility from him. You know, he taught me how to take care of myself. And as a result of that, today, I tell everybody, our job as parents is to teach our kids how to survive and take care of themselves when we're dead and gone. So you have to find various ways to do that. But growing up in Brookside, when he finally got to that promotion to sergeant, we moved, detective actually, we moved out to West Haven, over in Allentown in West Haven. And it was culture shock. I was suddenly surrounded by, everybody was Italian. It was a few Irish. Me and one other black family, our family and one other black family lived in the neighborhood, probably about a 12-mile radius. But again, here goes my mom. Mom was the queen of everything. So nothing intimidated mom. She didn't care what color you were. She didn't care what language you spoke. She was going to make you her friend, and she was going to gain something from that experience. And so she gave us that zest for life. And my sister and I got an older sister. I got a younger brother. Before he came along, my sister and I, we were attached at mom's hip. We did everything together with her. And she was a real big force in the community, and well-liked, loved by everyone. And she ended up working in the school system. She started out as a nursing assistant, but she ended up working in the school system. She immersed herself in the community. And, back then, there was a lot of subtlety with the racism stuff. But my mother made it a point to say, look, you're no better than your cousins because you moved out of the neighborhood. In fact, every weekend she would bring me and my sister back to the neighborhood and leave us, right? And say, you know, go out there. So at that point, I realized I was getting the best of both worlds. Like, I was getting a great education, and I knew it was purposeful. And, man, I learned how to speak Italian at a young age. I was involved in everything. Color wasn't a real barrier for me. I was still a leader as a kid. All the white kids in the neighborhood liked me. I liked them. It was the parents that had a problem. And so, again, education, life education, life lived experience, bro, I'm telling you, I had the best life of anybody you know. And that carried on to my career. But way back then, I remember getting these flashes of people challenging me and my mother and my sister. Now, you didn't challenge my mom, you know. And at one point, you know, as young kids, one of the parents did something really, really foul. And my mother found out about it, you know, an older white lady who was, you know, straight from the boat. And she made it very clear that she didn't want black people at her house and that sort of thing. But her kids and I were best friends, right? We got along great. But it's kind of interesting because the mother made it very clear that she was okay with us being friends, but her daughter was soon coming of age and she didn't want her to be attracted to a black boy. So that's why she didn't want me coming over. And so when my mother found that out, you know, my mother was the least racist person ever. She loved everybody. She went and met with that mother and gave her a what for. And I'll never forget. The story is very long. I won't share the whole story, but I remember looking at my mother thinking to myself, okay, sometimes you got to come out your face. And sometimes you got to make people understand that kindness is not weakness. And so I learned this coding. Talk about code switching. I learned to master that. And I went to work in 1982. I ended up becoming a police officer in Hampden where I had to utilize all those code switching skills. But I've had the best upbringing. Went to high school. Went to middle school in West Haven, Carrigan School. Shout out to Mavie Carrigan. Helped to develop me. And then went to Platt Tech in Milford. And again, at the time I went to Platt Tech in Milford, there were 13 black students in the entire school. And whether we knew each other and liked each other or not, we became very tight. We moved as a tribe, basically. But again, because of my upbringing, I was very comfortable. Nobody was better than me. Your skin didn't make you better than me, right? And I never allowed the N-word to define me, and I never allowed it to break me down, and because that's what they wanted. That would give them the win. And I'm like, you don't get a win with me. You know who I am? I'm Jackie Grady's son, like, it, period. And so truth of the matter was, I ended up being the leader there. I ended up getting a great following there and great friendships to this day with people that I went to Platt Tech with. We transcended the race issue, although they tried initially. Then they tried. They tried to not like me, you know, but I knew the game and I knew how to win that. And I say a lot of black folks don't necessarily feel that that's important. And unfortunately, we live in New England. So you don't have much of a choice but to learn how to get along with white folks. And, you know, not everybody's a racist. Not everybody hates you. I had a great upbringing and, you know, sort of watched the world change. I remember, you know, watching policing and what it was like. And you always hear people, especially people my age, talk about, well, back in the day, you know, Mrs. Johnson, she could beat your kid or whatever. It was bigger than that. It was much greater than that because there was a greater degree of respect and there was a greater degree of, I mean, you look at all the old film clips and the civil rights marches, authority mattered. You know what I mean? Authority mattered. Nowadays, authority is really, really, depending on who you are and how much money you got, authority doesn't matter sometimes. And I've always known that the uniform, matching shirt and pants, don't make you, right? I've always known that because I watched my uncles and my father. If they didn't have personality and connectivity to the community, it didn't matter the uniform, you know, because people respected them because of the uniform, but they didn't like them. because of the uniform. You had to be liked because of who you were. And that still holds true today. And I try to tell, I go into, you know, police academies across this country and I speak about that. And I said, listen, whoever you are when you got this job, don't ever change, because the job will jade you. You will start to look at people differently, but you're no more superior to anyone because of that matching shirt and pair of pants that you wear with that little piece of tin on your chest. Doesn't make you superior to anyone. What makes you effective at your job is your heart and your mind working together, and your ability to connect with other humanity. That's what makes you effective. And if you don't have that, you got to keep it going.
You're listening to the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, the Rhythm of the City. I'm Jose Candelario here having an in-depth conversation about his life. Charlie Grady, many of you know already who he is, but for those who don't know, Mr. Grady, you talk about your father and you spent very limited time with him. Shit, you got a story that you have, like this one time with dad?
Oh, man. I got a ton of stories. Now, when I say limited time, it's limited compared to what I spent with mom, obviously, because like we were attached to mom's hip. And he was working. He was building his empire. He was getting promoted up the scale at the police department. He was well-respected and loved. Legend, right? But I'll never forget one time. We were at Alexander's in Milford. Now, Alexander's was like the premier department store back then. It was sort of like Saks Fifth Avenue. And we drove up to Milford from West Haven, and we had to go get a suit for church. So back in the day, you know, me and my father, we matched. You know, he'd wear a suit, I'd wear a suit. He'd have a green hat on, I'd have a green hat on. You know, that was what we did to go to church. And so we pull into the parking lot, and he sees these four young black guys, and he says, oh, I know those guys. They're from New Haven. And he said their names, and he goes, they're here to steal cars. And I'm 11 years old. I'm like, Dad, come on, that's not right. I said, you know, you're something like the white people, that judge. He goes, nope. He said, it ain't got nothing to do with race, son. He goes, that's why they're here. That's what they do. And I said, nah. I said, I don't believe it. I said, you just got to stop. You've been a cop too long. You just, everybody. So he says, okay. So we go into the store. We buy what we got to buy. We come out. It's calm. It's cool. Those guys are nowhere to be gone, nowhere to be found. We start heading down the Boston Post Road. We hit orange, and we see a bunch of sirens and cop cars up ahead of us. And he said, remember I told you about those guys? I said, yeah. He goes, look up there. And there they were in a car that they stole from Milford. And they got stopped, and the orange police had their guns drawn on them. There apparently had to have been a little chase, whatever. And my father gets out of the car, and he says, stay here. He gets out of the car, and he walks over to the orange cop. He's, you know, like he's trying to say who he is, but the cop is so focused on holding his gun on these four black kids in this car, he's scared to death. You could see him visibly shaking, waiting for, you know, another backup to come. So there's now two cops. My father walks over and says, hey, I'm an officer. And they turn their guns on my father, because he's a black man walking up on them. And I said, hey, I said, he's a cop. And, you know, he says, I'm going to show you my badge. Now, the guys in the car knew my father, and you could hear them saying, oh, that's Grady. Grady's here. Oh, okay, we're good. Which was weird to me, but they were like, oh, okay. So the cops finally, you know, realized he was a police officer. He said, I know these guys. He says, put your guns away. He said, please. He says, I don't want no accidents. He says, let me talk to him. And they're like, oh. So he goes to the car. They let him walk to the car. They kept their guns trained on the car. He walks over to the car. He starts talking to them in the car. Next thing you know, he comes back. He says to one of the orange officers, give me a pair of your cuffs. He walks back over to the car with some cuffs, and he hands them to the kids and tell them to handcuff themselves to each other for safety. They got out of the car and surrendered, because my father talked them out of making any foolish mistakes. And I'll never forget, they were so happy to see my father. And I said, how did you know? He says, you have to understand something. He says, I know them. I know their cousins. I know their family. He says, they're struggling, and that's what they do. And I said, but they know you, and he says, they trust me. He says, I'm fair to them. He says, they break the law, I catch them. Sometimes I don't catch them. He says, so today they know I was going to make sure that they got home safe. And that blew my mind. Jose, when I tell you that blew my mind, I was like, okay, I guess that's what police are supposed to do, protect and serve. And so that's one of the most memorable stories that I have. But I got a ton of stories about being with my father at places because, you know, again, whenever he could, he'd try to attach me to his hip and, you know, I'd be in the car. He'd be at home and he'd have his scanner on. And I knew radio codes from New Haven Police Department better than a rookie cop coming out of the academy when I was like 8, 9, or 10 years old, because that's all I heard. And I saw all the cops come into the house talking with my dad. I hear the stories. So it was innate in me. It was, you know, sort of an environmental advantage being around law enforcement all those years. I swore I was not going to be a cop. I was going to be a lawyer. I was going to be anything, white collar. I was not going to be a cop. Not that being a cop was a bad thing, but they didn't make no money. I wanted to make some money. I want to live good. And it never dawned on me that it wasn't about the money when I was young. It was about what they did for the community. And so, you know, when I got older, I took the job for the job security. I became a police officer in Hamden for the job security. And because it was natural to me, I knew how to be a cop. Not that I wanted to be a cop, but I knew how to be a cop. And boy, that's when the real education started, because there was 3 black cops in Hamden at that time, me and 2 others. And I was the youngest one. And, you know, I was flashy, young, and just, you know, real cocky like most young guys are. And what an education. What an education.
So you get into the police academy, or you go through the police mm-hmm. academy, which is within itself a daunting task. You become part of the Hannah Police Force. Who was there for you? Because we always needed a mentor. We even when we don't realize that when we're cocky, we know it all. Mm-hmm. Who was your grounding force that really helped you navigate that police academy?
So
I mean, the police force.
So there was nobody on the police force in particular that I could turn to, but I had, again, uncles that were police officers, and they would be able to share with me, like, look, don't do that. That's just going to get you into a situation. I had situations where I had to actually turn to my father and go, is this what I'm supposed to be doing? Give you an example. At one point, boy, it had to be like 86, maybe 87, 1986 or 87. I think it was 87 now that I think of it. I was living in Cheshire with my girlfriend, and I was on my way home from Hamden. I was still in uniform. And up ahead at the Cheshire High School on Route 10, I saw white robes and white hoods carrying Confederate flags and American flags. I was floored. I could not believe what I was seeing. In 1987, I'm seeing the Ku Klux Klan marching. There was probably like 9 of them, and they were marching and waving their flags. And the Cheshire police were right across the street to make sure that they didn't get attacked or didn't cause any harm. So I was still partially in uniform. So I stopped my car and I look at them in awe, like, what is going on? In disbelief, I should say. And then I look over at the Cheshire cop, and he kind of shrugs his shoulders like, we're assigned to protect them. So I drove off, and I was devastated. I was like, this is insane, you know. And I don't care how old you are. I don't care where you come from. As a black person, you see 9 men in hoods and robes, you're going to feel something. I don't care how bad you are, you're going to feel something. And it hit me. So fast forward 2 or 3 days from that, I go to my job and I get a call from one of the lieutenants saying that same group was going to be in Hamden. And I was a motorcycle cop, and they wanted me to be out there protecting. So I need you to stop and think about that. They wanted me to be out there protecting the Klan. And I called my father. I'm like, yo, Pop, I ain't signed up for all this. I don't care about no uniform. I'm not protecting the Klan. And he sat me down. He's like, listen, you signed an oath to do a job. He says, their morals and their beliefs have nothing to do with your job. He said, you're going to do your job and you're going to do it well. He says, and everyone's going to have greater respect for you for being able to pull that off. And I said, but, you know, I'm going to look like Uncle Tom. He says, you're not going to look like anything but a cop doing his job that he's supposed to. Now, I still never 100% agreed with it because my plan was to be late so I didn't have to go. And as luck would have it, they canceled at the last minute, but I was out there ready to go just based on my father guiding me.
You are listening to the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, the rhythm of the city. I'm Jose Candelario. We're speaking with Charlie Grady, local legend now in his own right. You have moved on from the policing and taken on a mantle in our community and helping those returning citizens and those dealing with addiction, which is, you know, byproducts of our community. How are those skills in the early years translated into this role now?
Wow. So that's a great question, Jose, because what I recognized in 2012 was that my life leading up to 2012, I gained the skill set and a greater understanding of humanity in those years. I was always sort of like an old soul, and I always sort of took control. I always was that leader among my peers. But as I grew and I realized that what my role was as a police officer taught me so much about the human stain. It taught me so much about how to communicate better, how to make people come forward instead of be reclusive, because people are hurting. People need help. And as much as I didn't even sign up to be that guy, the more I worked with human beings, the more I worked with people, the more I felt that that was something that I was good at. That was something that I could do because people trusted me and I would deliver and I would help people. And so it all started at one point when I was a cop. I had these two young guys in Hamden. They were heroin addicts. They were addicted to heroin. One was 19, the other was 16. And, you know, two Italian white guys, and they were brothers. And I was fascinated at how they got addicted to heroin. They got addicted to heroin from their neighbor, who was like 22. And he turned them on to heroin. He turned a 19-year-old on to heroin at 15 because he was turned on to heroin at 15. And then the 19-year-old brother turned his 16-year-old brother onto heroin at 15. So I learned because, you know, back then the cop culture was very different. You're a junkie, you're a crackhead, you're all this stuff. There was no compassion whatsoever. It was like as if somebody woke up and said one day at, you know, 8, 9 years old, hey, you know what I want to be the rest of my life? I want to be a crackhead. I want to ruin my life. I want to be a heroin addict. I want to steal money from my parents. That doesn't happen. But we did not understand the level of a disease that substance addiction was. We just didn't have that training. We didn't have that knowledge. And ultimately, I started to see it, and I started to gain a greater respect, and I understood that this substance stuff hijacks the human brain, takes it over. And so I began to work with that, and I had all kinds of programs. My first program was with youth, single mothers raising young boys in Newhallville at the Hamden New Haven line, because I always found that niche where people needed help but weren't necessarily getting the help that they needed. So the work that I do today started a long time ago when I started realizing, you know, I have people in my family who were addicted to substances, and I realized that I love those people. Those people are, they're wonderful people. They have an issue. They have a problem. So I sort of looked at everybody that I worked with as one of my cousins. You know what I mean? Well, you look like my cousin so-and-so. You could be my, you know. Long story short, in 2012, I was working at the U.S. Attorney's Office as an investigator, and they started a program in the state of Connecticut, and I was charged with, it was an anti-gun violence, anti-gang strategy, and I was charged with taking care of Bridgeport, starting the program at Bridgeport. And I didn't really know many people in Bridgeport at the time, but I knew how to. And I got to Bridgeport, and I started running this program, and I realized that there's things missing from that program. And what they weren't doing was really, really getting to the crux of the problem. Like, they were just dealing with the symptoms. They weren't dealing with the actual root, right? So, and I started to read, and I started to educate myself a lot more on how do we deal with this? And so, you know, my mother-in-law used to say, you know, when a tree is growing and it starts to grow crooked, you have to put a brace on it to make sure it grows straight and becomes healthy and fruitful. And so I realized everything starts at the root. And we got people that are addicted to substances that have been molested at 8 years old, 6 years old. How do you expect those people to function normally if this is their past and the traumatic instances of their life? It's going to come out somewhere, somehow, the pain that people go through. So I became this guy who, instead of just saying, hey, how you doing? You all right today? And they go, yeah, I'm good, and walk away. No, really, how you doing? Talk to me, man, because I saw yesterday you were, you know, you didn't look too good. Let's talk. What's going on with you? And that's who I became. And I got to tell you, Jose, it's the most fulfilling thing I've ever done is knowing that I can tap in and help people that would otherwise shut people out. And so I have no formal training in psychology, none. I went to school to be an electrical engineer and didn't work in that field at all. Dropped out and became a cop. But what I've learned is humanity matters, and that's how I've lived my life. And so this program that I created in 2014 was the result of what was not being done. All these other programs, nonprofits, state programs, federal programs, were addressing the symptoms. They weren't addressing the root. And so I wanted to get to the root. And as a result, I realized that guys coming home weren't getting the services that they need. They weren't getting to the root of what put them in there in the first place. And they also weren't getting any real guidance on expectation when they came home. You know, so many of these guys come home from incarceration and they think they're free because they're living in a halfway house. You are not free living in a halfway house. You are still a property of the state living in a halfway house. They're telling you how to live. They're telling you where to go, how you can eat, and so forth. And so that frustrates them because they can smell the fresh air outside. They can walk outside to the bus stop. They can get a job and so forth. But then there's somebody going, nope, you got to be back here at 7 o'clock. You're not free. And so with that comes this false sense of, man, I'm angry. I thought I was getting out of jail. And now you're treating me like I'm still an inmate. So what I've done over the course of the years is work with those individuals and help them to navigate resetting their lives. So my programs are called the Social Service Navigation Hub, where we lock in with other programs that are providing services. And if they're truly providing services that they say they are, we'll work with you. But don't come at us with a lot of nonsense, fake numbers. And, you know, there's a whole lot of programs out here that have a lot of money and don't do nothing. And, you know, it's sad to me because there's no oversight. There's no oversight. You know, so a lot of these grants that come down and people get this crazy money, there's really no oversight on whether or not that money's truly being spent the way it's supposed to. And so I have intentionally stayed away from that level of red tape.
This is the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, the rhythm of the city. I'm Jose Canelori. We're speaking with Charlie Grady with his Navigation Hub. And let me just ask this, because a lot of programs struggle with a success, right? What determines a successful program? Because it's kind of hard to, you know, tabulate what that really means to provide those numbers. So what is an example of a successful program or a success with an individual?
That's a great question, too. So here's what we have to do. So for years, programs have allowed funders to dictate what success is. And so depending on what your outcome is expected to be, if I'm funding your program, I want to know that 10 people went to college. You know, I'm giving you money. I want to know 10 people went to college. They became whatever they're going to be. I want to know that the, you know, 5 kids got books in school. So what happens is that people struggle, these programs struggle to meet the criteria that's been set. Because I'm not giving you money unless you meet my criteria. That's how I'm going to fund you. And so the level of resources, the level of successes depends on how far you bend that curve. So if I know I've got to have 10 people that go to college, right, in order for me to keep getting this money, oh, I'm going to find 10 people, whether they're really going to college or not. I'm going to get them I'll get them enrolled. And all I got to do is show that they're enrolled in college, 10 of them, and you're going to keep giving me money. It doesn't show the real success of what happened with that. Did that kid actually stay in college? Did that kid actually flunk out because you didn't give him all the tools they needed to be, you know, enrolled? So what I do is we know the measure of success is stability, longevity, and the ability to redefine. So let's say someone comes to one of my programs and says, look, I've been in and out of jail 8 times, and I've been addicted to substances my whole life or whatever it's been. And usually within 6 months, you know, I've been back in jail. Right? So we get markers and we go, okay, if we can help you get past that marker, coming and being a part of what we're doing, and we sit with you and we say, okay, what is it that we're doing, or any of these other programs, what are they doing that's helping you to get past those your past history? And they'll say, look, I come here, I get support emotionally, I get essential needs taken care of, I have trust in this, and your staff helps me with this, this, and this. That's why I'm doing what I'm doing. So that's a metrics of success. Now you stretch that out, so you take a person like that, that has typically gone back or fallen back in substance addiction, whatever, and you get them into a year, 2 years later. Well, I have people that have been coming to my program called Hang Time for 10 years. We've been in existence for 10 years. This year's our 10-year anniversary, and I have people that have, not only have they been coming, but they've referred their family members. I've got generations that come to Hang Time.
Before we continue with Hang Time, I know you're very proud of Hang Time. You have meetings in Bridgeport and New Haven and Waterbury.
Waterbury, yeah.
You got it. All right. Talk a little bit about Hang Time, the dates and the days that it's available and where.
Okay, great. So Hang Time, we operate every single Tuesday in Bridgeport at 2470 Fairfield Avenue, the Borough Center. Starts at 5:45. It's over at 8:15. That's every single Tuesday. And I can tell you with pride that we average anywhere between 60 and 80 people that show up there. Now, these are people from the community. It's not all people that have been incarcerated, but about 60% of the people that attend are formerly incarcerated or just coming home, living in a halfway house. And the reason that's significant is because you're putting those individuals trying to reset their lives in a room with people from the community, business owners, pastors, COs, judges, you name it. The community is highly represented in this room every single Tuesday night. So I cannot tell you how many times someone who's come home from incarceration is sitting next to someone else and they're laughing and they're eating food and they're breaking bread and having a good time. And the guy who's coming home from incarceration doesn't even know that the guy he's talking to owns a landscape company. And before the night's over, he goes, hey, I like you. Why don't you come work for me? Right? That's integration. That's true integration. Putting a bunch of people from a halfway house in a room, having a group session where they just complain about the circumstances, how is that integrating them back into society? How is that giving them a more positive outlook and giving them hope on how to move forward? But I put them in a room with a state prosecutor who's off duty, sitting down having dinner with them, right? The respect level is built on who they are as a human being, not the worst things they've ever done. So that doesn't happen anywhere. We do that every Tuesday in Bridgeport, every other Thursday in New Haven at the Continuum of Care building. They're one of our greatest partners, Continuum of Care in New Haven, on Legion Avenue, every other Thursday. And then at the OIC building in Waterbury, 77 Bishop Street. So when we're not in New Haven, we'll be in Waterbury. So tonight is New Haven, Thursday in New Haven. But the key is we typically average anywhere between 35, 45 people in New Haven, Waterbury, and people will travel. Jose, when I tell you, in Bridgeport, there are people in that room as far away as New London, Greenwich, Danbury, New Milford, Hartford, they drive to be in that room because the feeling that happens in that room, true community, it's a microcosm of a society that we all wish we lived in every day. So you walk in that room, you're greeted with a hug and a smile. And if you don't want to be hugged, you smile and a handshake. Everybody in that room is taking care of each other's.
You're a returning citizen right now. You're out there. You're listening. That's you're right. A family member because you also focus on family members, right, because they are also affected by the incarceration. It's just not the person being incarcerated. Right. It's a whole community that's affected by the circumstance. How can they get in touch with you?
So they can actually reach out to our website. It's Hang Time Real Talk. One word, hangtimerealtalk.com. There's a phone number on there that they can reach out to. We'll have a schedule up on our website. We also have a program called Connecticut Hall of Change, which is a whole nother animal that we created in 2019. But for those that are looking for support, please look us up, hangtimerealtalk.com, and find out where our sessions are. Now, the key is we never overpromise and underdeliver. So when we bring in resources, we typically bring in resources that families might not otherwise hear about if they weren't in the room, or those coming home might not hear about if they're not in the room. So there's a ton of resources out there.
Now we're going to get into the nitty gritty here and talk about the Connecticut Hall of Change, the Grade 8.
Yes.
You celebrate successes of returning citizens and you shine a light on the progress that they make.
That's right.
When did this start and how did this idea come about?
Yeah, so it's kind of crazy. 2019, I tell this story. I'm laying in bed watching 10 o'clock news with my wife, and one of the rare times she let me hold the remote. But a newscaster comes on and she says, "And in other news, a career criminal is going back to jail." And I'm looking at this guy on the screen. And I'm thinking to myself, he's way more than a career. Like, who gave him that title, career criminal? Did he get in trouble his whole life? Yeah, probably. But I don't think, once again, that he ever woke up and said, "You know what I want to be today? I want to be a career criminal for the rest of my life." I don't think that's the way it works, especially since I recognize that guy as having a sister, a brother, a mother, somebody, and a lot of people love that guy, right? So why is his title for the rest of his life criminal? So I said, with all the wonderful people I work with that have overcome these obstacles and that scarlet letter of felon, I'm going to help change that. I need to change the stigma, because that poor young man, no matter what he does, he's going to walk in someplace and they're going to be like, "Oh, you're that career criminal guy." No. We need to help change that, especially those that have turned their lives around and over a course of 5 years or more proven that they not only turned their lives around, but they're doing great things to give back to the community. So it's one thing to turn yourself around. You get a job, you get a nice house, you're like, "Yay, me." But the people we honor each year are the people who achieve that, plus give back to the community that they once violated, that come back and do things with youth, come back and do things with the homeless, come back and do things with those addicted to substance. Those are the people that we honor. And those are the remarkable people. They're unsung heroes. And a lot of them don't even want to be recognized. And a lot of them don't even want anyone to know about their criminal background until I started this thing. So within 2 weeks of me having that idea, laying in bed, I said, "Tomorrow I'm going to start a program that's going to help change that stigma. I want to change it, and I want these people to be recognized that are doing great things for the awesome ability they have to overcome the obstacles." Jose, do you realize how many obstacles there are for someone with a felony record trying to not just come home and get an apartment, but can't even get life insurance, can't even get driver's license oftentimes, can't even get certain inalienable rights restored? And so those people that have done, listen, members of the Grade 8, we've got people that have their doctorate's degree, right? We have people that were once incarcerated that now work in law enforcement, as counselors, as police officers. You name it, these people have overcome the odds and are remarkable people. For them to be able to achieve what they achieve, they've had to do twice as much as the average person with a college degree, just in real life. And so we honor them each year. It's called the Hall of Change, play on the name Fame. And we just did our fifth year celebration up in Hartford, the capital city, at Hartford Theater Works. Big shout out to Hartford Theater Works. They've been a great partner with us. But it's basically the Oscars for reentry. We have the top of the top, the cream of the creme, that are doing great stuff. We honor them in a ball and gown ceremony. We have live entertainment. It's a phenomenal event ceremony. They're sworn in. And the best part is the people who make it into the Hall of Change are memorialized in a state museum. And their stories, their lives, their imagery lives on forever. I don't know about you, but I know I'm not going to end up in no museum. But the truth of the matter is these people who have done such great things in their community, they are enshrined in a museum, a state museum. This isn't like, you know, Pito's cousin's basement museum. This is a state-owned and operated museum. We're the first in the country to do this, and it's now going to be replicated in other places.
You've been listening to the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, the Rhythm of the City. I'm Jose Canelario, and we have been speaking with Charlie Grady. We're at the end of the show. Time flies. We are done here. What are your final words or a message for the community? That the stage is all yours.
So, you know, again, let me go back to thanking you, man. This has been great. You know, I appreciate your brain and the way it works. And we've had some great discussion on and off. I think my final words are to anyone who's listening out there. We are in crisis. Our communities are in crisis. People are turning to substances to hide pain. We have this thing called urban trauma, and my good friend Dr. Maisa Akbar writes about it, and several of other professionals, mental health workers, speak to it. And we engage it, we see it on a regular basis, but we're always waiting for someone else to fix it, someone else to address it. And I want everyone out there to be encouraged. Everyone out there knows someone who needs help, but you're waiting for someone else to help that person. I'm encouraging you to jump in, because I've had instances where family members, friends knew of severe trauma and severe mental illness, and they didn't speak up. And ultimately, the person goes out and kills someone, or ultimately the person goes out and does some horrific crime. And so that's got to make you feel a little guilty. And I say, rather than sit back down the road and go, boy, we probably should have got Robbie some help. We probably should have got Sheila, you know, jump in. It takes a village, and you're a part of that village. You know, you're busy with your everyday life, but we become desensitized if it doesn't directly affect us. You know, I tell people all the time, initially, you know, when people hear about fentanyl overdoses, you know, you see on the news a woman falls asleep or she goes into a stupor while in her car driving with her kids in the back. Everyone's like, oh, my God, that's terrible. You know, we have to do something about that. Who's we? Who's we? But we become so desensitized to it that after a while, when you hear it so much, you walk in the door with groceries and you hear that on the news and you go, oh, my God, that's terrible. Hey, hand me the mustard over there. Put this bag over there. We become desensitized. And what I'm saying to everyone who's listening, pay attention. Pay attention to your neighbors and your family and your friends. Don't just ask them how you're doing and expect that knee-jerk reaction. Oh, I'm good. Really dig in. Ask them how they're doing.
This is Charlie Grady, ladies and gentlemen. www.hangtimerealtalk.com. For more information and to get in touch with them, please do so. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate you.
This has been the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, the Rhythm of the City. I'm Jose Candelario. And like always, thank you for your listen.